Hi, this podcast is brought to you by Medicom Medical Publishers. My name is Dr. Rachel Giles, and today I'm going to be talking about some of the most exciting abstracts that were presented at the European Association for Urology, held in July 2020, and it was a virtual meeting for the first time. So I'd like to kick off by talking about the LAP01 study, which was presented by Professor Jens Uwe Stolzenberg and the University of Leipzig in Germany. And this was a prospective multi-center randomized trial, and it really aimed to generate conclusive data supporting the improved continence after robotic-assisted radical prostatectomy, so RLRPE, in a prospective setting, and it took place in four different German sites. So patients at the time of cutoff, 713 patients had been randomized 3-to-1 to either receive robotic-assisted, that was 527 patients, or conventional laparoscopic radical prostatectomy, that was 186 patients. Patients were blinded to their arm allocation until month 3. The primary endpoint of this study was continence restoration at month 3, as defined by not requiring a pad for 3 or more consecutive days. Post-operative follow-up would be continued for 3 years, with assessments planned for 1, 3, 6, 12, 24, and 36 months. Professor Stolzenberg, he just presented the data that's up to 12 months. Overall, the complication rates were lower in the patients who received robotic surgery. Perioperative outcomes were comparable between both arms, including nerve-sparing sites, prostate size, weight, margin status, pathological tumor stage, duration of surgery, and duration of catheterization. However, the primary endpoint was met. Continence rates among the patients treated robotically were significantly higher at 3 months, with a p-value of under 0.0001. At 6 months, the p-value was 0.004, and at 12 months, p-value was 0.04. Continued follow-up will determine the long-term effects. So overall, the new findings from the first prospective multi-center randomized trial demonstrated improved continence for patients undergoing robotic-assisted radical prostatectomy as compared with conventional laparoscopic radical prostatectomy. Next, we jump over to a talk that was about bladder cancer, in fact, specifically non-muscle invasive bladder cancer. And it was presented by Professor Mark Oliver Grimm from the University Hospital Jena in Germany. And this was an analysis in the recurrent risk of patients with high-grade non-muscle invasive bladder cancer in the randomized phase 3 NIMBUS trial. Professor Grimm, he explained that given the BCG shortage, which is looming, and also, of course, the toxicities associated with BCG use, NIMBUS really set out to investigate whether a reduced frequency of installations, of BCG installations, during induction and maintenance could actually result in non-inferior clinical efficacy, with obviously the potential benefits that would go with that of fewer adverse events, as well as reduced inconvenience and costs. The primary endpoint of this trial was the time to the first recurrence, with the two different schedules being compared directly to each other. Key secondary outcomes were the number and grade of recurrent tumors, the rate of progression to muscle invasive disease, and safety. At data cutoff, 345 BCG-naive high-grade NMIBC patients were randomized, and patients could have primary or recurrent disease, solitary or multiple tumors, with or without concurrent carcinoma in situ, and with the absence of high-grade papillary disease following repeat transurethral resection of bladder tumor, TURBT. The standard frequency arm allowed EAU guidelines recommendation that intermediate or high-risk NMIBC patients and those with carcinoma in situ receive 15 adjuvant BCG installations, and there were 170 patients in that group. And the baseline characteristics were well-balanced between both arms. The reduced frequency arm had a total of 9 BCG installations, and there were 175 patients in that arm. And the safety data was based on a safety set of 165 patients in each arm. In the entire NIMBUS cohort, 67 patients had recurrence. That's 19.4%. And 7 patients, 2%, had progression to muscle-invasive disease. Recurrences were most frequent in patients with reduced frequency BCG installations, and that was 27% versus 12% in the EAU guidelines cohort. Yet progression was numerically lower in the patients treated with reduced frequency, and that was 0.6% versus 3.4%. However, the primary endpoint, which was time to recurrence, was significantly different between the arms, and there was a lower recurrence-free survival among the patients who received the reduced frequency BCG at 34% versus 15%, and that was a significant value with a hazard ratio of 0.4. The time to recurrence in the patients who had been observed for at least 6 months since randomization in the study provided actually similarly disappointing results, 33% versus 14%, with a hazard rate of 0.39. So in conclusion, reducing the frequency of BCG instillations during induction and maintenance is inferior to the standard BCG schedule regarding time to first recurrence. However, the fact that early recurrences occurred in the reduced frequency arm points to the value of receiving an instillation every week during the induction phase. As anticipated, reduced frequency did result in fewer patients with adverse events, with consequent lower symptom burden. The discussant was Professor Peter Black from the University of British Columbia in Canada. He pointed out that BCG really is effective, and instead of replacing it in future regimens that we are going to do, perhaps the next steps we should really focus on building on its efficacy, perhaps by immune priming, and that he cited the SWOG 1602 trial, or by using genetically modified BCG, and he cited VPM 1002, or through rational combination therapies like a sting antagonist or agonist. All in all, I think it's safe to say that reduction in the frequency of BCG vaccine instillations during the induction and maintenance treatment for non-muscle invasive bladder cancer resulted in earlier disease recurrence relative to a standard instillation schedule. Disappointing, but that's the way it is. Adding news for bladder cancer, there was a multicenter open-label phase 3 study which investigated nadofaragene firadenovec in BCG-unresponsive non-muscle invasive bladder cancer patients. This was presented by Dr. Neil Shore from the Carolina Urologic Research Center in the U.S., and he presented the outcomes of the papillary disease cohort of this study. The NADO, which is what I'm going to call it from here on out, it's a difficult name, it's a novel intravesical-administered adenovirus-mediated gene therapy, which delivers the human interferon alpha-2b gene. When combined with the excipient SYN3, it's been really shown in phase 2 trials previously to be really well-tolerated, and it leads to sustained localized interferon alpha-2b gene expression. So the phase 3 trial, it enrolled 157 patients who had a mean age of 71 years. 50 of these patients had papillary disease. Intravesical administration of NADO, and they used about 3,033 viral particles. It was planned every 3 months for up to 4 doses during 12 months. All patients with an absence of high-grade disease recurrence at month 12 were offered continued therapy for every 3 months thereafter. The primary endpoint was complete response at any time in the carcinoma in situ cohort, unresponsive to BCG. Key secondary endpoints included the rate and durability of high-grade recurrence-free survival, as well as safety in patients with papillary disease. The efficacy population consisted of 48 patients with papillary disease. Of those, 35 of whom, so 73%, achieved recurrence-free survival at 3 months, and 62.5% at 6 months, and it only went down a bit more to 58.3% at 9 months, and 43.8% at 12 months. The primary endpoint was therefore met, and 55 patients, so of the 103, and that's 53.4%, in the carcinoma in situ cohort achieved complete response during the 12-month period. The total cohort, and is 151, had a nearly 60% complete rate response rate, whereas 73% of the papillary group subgroup achieved a complete response. All complete responses occurred during the first 3 months, which is a really interesting finding. Patients with carcinoma in situ demonstrated 24% of HGRF at month 12, and that was about 44% of the papillary patients. In papillary patients, the median duration of HGRF was a little over 12 months, and the most common drug-related treatment emergent adverse event was instillation site discharge at about one-third of the patients, fatigue in about a quarter of the patients, bladder spasm happening in about 20% of the patients, and hematuria happening in about 17% of the patients. Not a single patient died happily. So all in all, this exciting, fairly large trial investigating an investigational drug called NADO did achieve encouraging, durable, high-grade, and recurrence-free survival. Next, I want to talk about the PROPSMA study. This was using labeled prostate-specific membrane antigen, which is PSMA, and in a PET CT fusion scan, and it examined whether this was superior in specificity and sensitivity to conventional imaging in the pre-treatment staging phase of intermediate and high-risk localized prostate cancer. These data were presented by Professor Michael Hofmann from the Peter MacCallum Cancer Center in Melbourne, Australia, and the PROSMA study was also recently published in The Lancet, I believe, in April 2020. The rationale of this study was that pre-treatment staging of intermediate and high-risk localized prostate cancer is really important for treatment choice, yet the current standard of imaging really has limited sensitivity. The study presented here really investigated whether imaging using PSMA PET CT was superior to conventional imaging in the pre-treatment staging phase. Men with histologically confirmed prostate cancer were being considered for curative intent radical prostatectomy or radiotherapy. There were 302 men. They were randomly allocated to either conventional imaging using bone scan and CT per the standard of care, that was 152 of those men, or gallium-68 PSMA 11 PET CT, 150 patients in that cohort. The study was stratified by study site. So in patients with less than 3 unequivocal sites of metastasis, crossover imaging for confirmation was performed within 14 days, which occurred in 96% of the patients in that conventional imaging arm. The primary endpoint was the accuracy of first-line diagnostic imaging for the identification of either pelvic, nodal, or distant metastatic disease using the area under the curve of the receiver operating characteristic, ROC. The reference standard was a composite panel of histopathology, imaging, clinical, and biochemical characteristics. One thing that's always interesting for this kind of study is that reporter agreement really was high for determining the nodal and distant metastatic disease across sites. In the primary outcome assessment, the PSMA PET CT had a 27% absolute greater AUC for accuracy compared to conventional imaging, and that was 92% versus 65%, with a p-value of less than 0.001. Conventional imaging had both a lower sensitivity, 38% versus 85%, as well as a lower specificity, which was 91% versus 98%. Further post hoc subgroup analyses showed that an incremental benefit for PSMA PET CT in men with Gleason grade group 4 to 5 disease, those with less than 3 metastatic sites, and those with a PSA of greater than 20 nanograms per milliliter. The clinical value of PSMA PET CT was analyzed by treatment changes that occurred as a result of pretreatment staging imaging. In the conventional staging arm, 23 men had consequent treatment change, 15% of them, as compared to 41 men in the PSMA PET CT arm, and so that was 28%. So 15% versus 28%. Those are a lot of changes in treatment options. These changes included both a transition from curative intent to palliative intent treatment in 20 patients, that's 14%, as well as a change in treatment approach in 22 men, which is, again, 14%. With regard to safety, patients receiving conventional imaging had a higher radiation exposure when compared with patients receiving PSMA PET CT. And so the conventional imaging cohort received a median of 19.2 MSV, and the PSMA PET CT cohort received 8.4 MSV. So the PSMA PET CT was not associated with any adverse events. The concluding was that gallium labeling the prostate-specific membrane antigen, the PSMA, and the PET CT fusion, it really was superior in specificity and sensitivity to conventional imaging, and that's been validated now for the pre-treatment staging phase for intermediate and high-risk localized prostate cancer. Moving to lower urinary tract symptoms, which were due to benign prostatic hyperplasia, Dr. Neil Barber from the Frimley Health NHS Foundation Trust in the UK presented the 2-year outcomes of the WATER study. This study compared the safety and efficacy of prostate ablation using aquablation therapy, which is a robotic heat-free water jet prostate resection technique, and it compared it with TURP for LUTS outcomes. In this randomized, double-blinded, global multicenter phase 3 trial, 184 men with moderate to severe LUTS related to BPH were assigned aquablation therapy either 117 of them, versus TERP, which was 67 of them. Baseline characteristics of patients in both arms were comparable, with no significant differences in any of the characteristics tested. The trial had a co-primary safety and efficacy endpoint, which was designed to show non-inferiority regarding efficacy. The proportion of subjects with adverse events rated as probably or definitely related to the study procedure classified as Clavien-Dindo grade 2 or higher, or any grade 1 event resulting in persistent disability, such as ejaculatory disorder or erectile dysfunction, as evidenced through 3 months post-treatment, together with the primary efficacy endpoint of the International Prostate Symptoms Score, change from baseline to 6 months. Patients and assessors were blinded to treatment. Data was collected using the IPSS score, male sexual health questionnaire, and the International Index for Erectile Function and Uroflow. With 2 years of follow-up, aquablation therapy showed similar symptom score comparisons and uroflow measurements as compared to TERP at all time points measured, so at baseline, 3 months, 6 months, 12 months, and 24 months. Aquablation therapy also saw consistent uroflow improvement from 6 months to 2 years. Low retreatment rates were observed for both arms, but there was no differences in any case between the two arms. Aquablation and TERP showed no differences with regard to PSA reduction during that period of time. Symptom improvement scores were comparable to other resection techniques. The aquablation technique demonstrated a significantly lower rate of sexual dysfunction, however, at the primary safety endpoint at 3 months. The CD1P measure, which measures incontinence, erectile dysfunction, and ejaculatory dysfunction, was lower in the aquablation arm, so 6.9% versus 24.6% in the TERP arm. These data held true when combined with the CD2 score, so events requiring pharmacological treatment, blood transfusion, endoscopic or surgical or radiological intervention, and those was 26% in the aquablation group versus 42% in the TERP group. So in conclusion, the results from the WATER study demonstrate aquablation to be a safe and effective alternative to TERP. Next, I want to talk about the presentation from Dr. Andreas Josefsson. He's from Gothenburg in Sweden, and he presented the SPCG-14 study, which was a prospective multicenter phase 2 clinical trial of bicalutamide alone or with the addition of docetaxel in non-metastatic prostate cancer with a rising PSA. This trial assessed whether or not any benefit could be gained by adding docetaxel-based chemotherapy to hormonal therapy alone in the population of prostate cancer patients who only have biochemically relapsed disease after curative treatment, and the PSA doubling time was less than 12 months. The investigators hypothesized further that the approach would be likely to be effective at a time of minimal tumor burden prior to radiographic relapse, resulting in a minimization of the overall burden of therapy and that consequently an improved quality of life while in treatment. A total of 345 patients were randomized 1-to-1. The control arm, which was 174 patients, received anti-androgen therapy once daily, and the experimental arm, which was 171 patients, received treatment with docetaxel for 10 cycles, as well as the anti-androgen. The median participant age was 68 years old, and the majority of patients had Gleason grade of 7 or less, with 26% having Gleason grade greater than 8. The primary endpoint was progression-free survival, defined as a PSA of more than 2 milligrams per milliliter above nadir, metastasis, or death due to any cause. With a median follow-up of 36 months, 5-year progression occurred in 46% of all patients. 15% developed metastatic disease, and 10% of the patients died. Among those with no progression, median follow-up was 47 months. The primary endpoint, however, was met, and improved progression-free survival was reached by patients receiving antiandrogen therapy plus docetaxel as compared with antiandrogen therapy alone. And there was a hazard ratio of 0.72 and a p-value of 0.041. There were no differences between the subgroups of patients based on prior curative intent treatment and PSA doubling time less than 6 months or based on age. So with regard to safety outcomes, toxicity, however, really was substantial. The most common serious adverse event was febrile neutropenia, which occurred in 26% of the cohort. Notably, 62% of the participants in the investigation arm terminated docetaxel treatment as a result of adverse events or serious adverse events. In the era of other, targeted therapies like apalutamide or darolutamide and enzalutamide, where demonstrated effects on metastasis-free survival and even overall survival have been recently reported, one has to wonder if the current data really shows improvement in progression-free survival will be enough to change practice. However, what is attractive about this study is that docetaxel is very accessible worldwide, and you know it does place this regimen with fairly strong clinical evidence as an acceptable option for some situations. Lastly, I want to touch on new data from the Serpents study about urosepsis, and this was presented by Dr. Zafar Tondogdu from the University College London in the UK. And this is a study that has about 600 patients in it. It's a prospective observational study, and it specifically looks at outcomes for urosepsis. So defining the diagnostic criteria in the sepsis field has been really problematic, but most researchers pretty much now agree that the suspicion for infection coupled with an assessment of mental state of the patient and either the systematic inflammatory response syndrome, that's SIRS, or the National Early Warning Score, NEWS, those are validated tools, and probably the combination of those items will constitute the best approach for the identification of severe sepsis and septic shock. The susceptibility profile of each patient should be really carefully evaluated at the baseline at the time of diagnosis of urosepsis. Most patients will develop urosepsis within 10 days of an intervention if they're going to, and up to one-third of patients that receive interventions may have localized septic problems. Many patients will have had previous urosepsis, and 43% of the patients will have had a recent urinary tract infection, previous hospitalization, or are diabetic. Overall, about half of the urosepsis patients have more than one comorbidity, and baseline catheter burden should always be evaluated as well. So 30-day outcomes from the Serpents database indicate that mortality is actually significantly reduced in urosepsis at only 2.8% versus 20% for other site mortality. This reduction may be attributed to the fact that urosepsis, it's a less aggressive septic condition compared with other septic sources, probably because we have the ability to gain local control relatively quickly with urosepsis. Among the patients who did die, 75% of them were determined to have severe sepsis, and 25% of them had systematic inflammatory response syndrome, SIRS. So the clinical failure rate was 15% in this study, 77% of whom had severe sepsis. There really is a high burden of disease on the urosepsis patient, including local and distant damage, and up to 10 to 15% of the patients will acquire a recurrent infection. The main determinants of clinical failure are age and comorbidities, like Parkinson's disease, also catheter burden, acute kidney injury, which can be acquired, and resting respiratory rate. Previous admissions and antibiotic histories are really important in addition to previous UTI burden. Dr. Tondogdu, he commented on the current discussion in sepsis management as a struggle between personalization versus protocolization. Although the concept of quote-unquote each hour saves lives really has led to early administration of antibiotics, only 57 to 80% of the patients have been shown to actually have sepsis when they've been admitted with suspicion of sepsis, meaning that we're over-treating patients. In non-septic shock patients, there really is a window of time to identify the pathogen and apply specific treatments and individualize it to the patient based on their comorbidities and so forth. In a prospective observational study, there were 67 patients, 34% of whom received inappropriate antibiotics. Despite the overuse of antibiotics, there really was no impact on the mortality, so broad-spectrum antibiotics don't necessarily save lives, and individual patient characteristics turned out to be more relevant to patient outcomes. The take-home message from this talk was, quote, "Don't delay antibiotics, but do use them cautiously and selectively." Thank you for your attention.